barrage of rockets back at the regime in the occupied Sheba farms. Now, the equation in the region has transitioned as Israeli aggression is immediately met by the resistance, which responds accordingly. Another significant variable this time around seems to be the unity of the resistance front against the Zionist regime. We'll be looking at all of this on the Spotlight. First of all, I'd like to start off in Beirut with Press TV's Mariam Saleh. Mariam, thanks so much for being with us. Well, fill us in on the situation, of course, even as we're talking right now. Said Hassan Nasrallah is finishing his speech, but tell us about the significance, the points, some of the points that he made about what has happened.
Yes, of course, he gave very significant points when it comes to the issue of retaliating and confronting Israel. He stressed, of course, the fact that we do have a new regional equation, which would, of course, lead to a solidarity between all of the resistance groups. But he has spoken about this extensively before. Today, he focused a little bit more on exactly what happened on the Israeli shelling of areas. And this is the first time in 15 years that we have a shelling from the Air Force, from the Israeli military Air Force. And that is why he said that Hezbollah was quick to respond, quick to make sure to take things back to the deterrence equation that was sustained since the end of the 2006 war, which lasted for 33 days. As you know, now we are commemorating that event. It began in July and ended in August. So therefore, Sayyid Nasrallah also explained why Hezbollah was quick to respond, why he has not retaliated, for example, for the martyrdom of certain fighters that were killed, whether in Syria or on the border with Lebanon during protests in solidarity with Al-Quds, the Sword of Al-Quds. He said that this is only to stress the fact and tell the Israelis that it is forbidden to launch the shelling from your air force, whether even if it is on open territory. As you know, the Israelis launched on Thursday some shelling in open territory. Therefore, as Hezbollah was quick to respond, also on open territory in the occupied Sheba farms. But he also stressed that next time it will not be only in the Sheba farms. It could even be in targets in occupied Palestine or in the occupied Golan Heights.
And I thought it was interesting, Mariam, one point that also he made was that the resistance initiated that attack during the day because they didn't want to initiate terror against civilians. The opposite, of course, of what the Israeli regime did and, of course, initiated those attacks on Lebanon in the middle of the night. Thanks so much for that update out of Beirut. That's Mariam Saleh. And now I'd like to welcome my guests to the program. Another guest, author and journalist Jim Kavanaugh out of New York. And historian and journalist Brett Yonkers out of Halset. Thank you both for being with us. I'm going to start this off in New York with Jim. Your take, Jim, why do you think that Israel initiated this attack on Lebanon now?
I'm not sure. You know, as your correspondent said, it seems to have been an attack on an open area, which, you know, doesn't seem to have much rationale to it. The response by Hezbollah also was an open area. I think they were trying to provoke Hezbollah into a response. Hezbollah did, this is the first time in 15 years they've claimed a rocket attack against Israel. And they made very clear, we deliberately put it into the into an open area, et cetera. And I think really what you have is Israel is dying to get into war with Lebanon, with Iran. And they're trying to provoke something, I think. So generally speaking, I think that would be, you know, their stance after the supposed missile attack or the drone attack on the ship in the Gulf was we have to go to war with Iran. And they're trying to get the Americans to go along with that. So I think they're hoping to provoke something that would be a casus belli, that they could present as a casus belli to the world.
Brett, your thoughts on that. Do you think that Israel wants to go to war on Lebanon?
Well, I think this is definitely a strong possibility. We have to bear in mind that Israel itself is coming out of years of political strife and internal struggle within the Zionist entity itself. When you read mainstream media in the West, they often like to talk about the fact that Lebanon is mired in political strife and infighting on the political level, but the same goes, of course, for the Zionist entity itself. They have had several elections in the span of just a couple of years, and eventually they had to find a form of unity government in order to get Benjamin Netanyahu out, a unity government with eight parties that have a very fragile balance right now, which has seen Naftali Bennett come to power, but on a very fragile and very shaky ground that he is standing on. And in fact, the issues that have been plaguing the Zionist entity have been so big that in many cases during these elections, they didn't even talk about what to do with Palestine, what to do with the resistance, because they were too busy talking about the internal actual struggles that plagued people over there. So from that point of view, it is very important, I think, for a Zionist politician, especially an aggressive hawkish politician such as Naftali Bennett, to try to lure all the attention away from the internal problems and struggles of his colonial regime and instead focus the attention on a potential foreign war that he's probably hoping to bring to a swift and successful conclusion. This is playing by the book that has been going along for hundreds and hundreds of years, of course, especially in imperial politics, is whenever you have internal domestic struggle, try to find an external enemy and go to war. The United States has been doing that for nearly 300 years now, and it has at times really worked in order to save politicians' political career. And this is something that I think Naftali Bennett is trying now as well. Mm-hmm. Added to that, of course, there might be something to it that it's the 15th anniversary of the 2006 war in which Lebanon, led by Hezbollah, of course, dealt a sound defeat against the Zionist forces. And they are now, of course, celebrating this. So what better time to try to lure Lebanon into another war from the Zionist point of view than during this 15th anniversary? This might also be somewhat of a symbolic gesture on their behalf.
Okay, well, Jim, what about that, what Brett said? Because if that's the case, he talked about in basically uniting the people at home with a foreign war. But the other side of that would be Hezbollah is not an easy target, obviously. Tel Aviv saw that in 2006. And now if we fast forward 15 years later, Hezbollah has had a tremendous amount of experience now in dealing with Syria and elsewhere. Do you agree that Tel Aviv is willing to risk whatever it has to take on Hezbollah and its allies?
I think they're in a quandary about that. Yes, you're absolutely right. Hezbollah, they perceive Hezbollah as a threat now because they're afraid that Hezbollah has precision missiles, and they very well might, and they have a lot of missiles anyway, and they know they have missiles that can hit anywhere in Israel. And it's quite clear that if there's an attack on Iran or Lebanon, Hezbollah is going to launch missiles that will strike the heart of Israel. And Israel doesn't, they really don't know what to do about it, because on the one hand, they're watching them get stronger, so they think we have to do something, we have to go out and attack them, but they also know if they do, they might get hit very strongly. And that's why there was a little dance here where the Israelis themselves kind of pulled back at the end and said, okay, you know, we're going to accept this, we're not going to go any further. But what they want to do is they want to find out what the capabilities of Hezbollah are. And they want to destroy Lebanon. They want to try and get rid of Hezbollah with financial crisis and with economic siege, which is what they're doing. You know, all this business about we've got to reform Lebanon. Lebanese politics do have to be reformed. But what the Israelis and the Americans mean by that is you've got to get rid of Hezbollah. So they're trying on all fronts to get rid of Hezbollah, to weaken Hezbollah. But they're also, and they have been for years, trying to get the United States to agree with them to attack Iran. Now, and that's why they keep saying that. So this is really part of a strategy that's difficult for the Israelis to negotiate, because they're already at the point where they're going to be hit hard. You know, and as one Iranian commander had said at some point, you know, when the missiles start raining down in Tel Aviv, you're going to see a lot of people going back to Brooklyn. And so this is something that the Israelis can't take, but they can't just sit back and they feel like we can't just sit back and watch Iran and Hezbollah get stronger, because we want to be in the position where we can do militarily whatever we want to any country in the region that we want. We can bomb Syria every day. We can blow up Iranian tankers in the Gulf, you know, but they can't do anything to us. And Hezbollah is saying to a certain extent with this, look, we're willing to attack you. We're not going to be shy about saying we sent these rockets. So Israel has to figure out what to do about that, and it's a quandary for Israel.
What about, Brett, the difference between Hezbollah 2006 and Hezbollah 2021?
There is the difference between the two is, in such a way, in terms of military capabilities, that it would be the capacities of Hezbollah right now in terms of military and political strength would be almost inconceivable, I think, to an onlooker back in 2006. There have been studies done into the military power, or at least estimates into the military power of Hezbollah, that say that the Hezbollah rocket and missile capacity is on par with that of an average NATO member state, of course, not taking into consideration the military powerhouse of the United States itself. So this is, Hezbollah is by itself has a military strength of a small country. They have the support of an actual country, of the majority of an actual country, of Lebanon, of the Lebanese people. They have support across sectarian lines, across ethnic lines, across religious differences, as a almost universally respected member and leader locally of the resistance against Zionism. So this power that Hezbollah has been showcasing, I think, and has been building up the past 15 years, is of such an extent that I think that even the Israelis themselves have massively underestimated this. Indeed, I agree with the other guest. Indeed, what has been said is they're sort of somewhat testing the waters, and they're seeing how strong exactly Lebanon is. But I think we have seen by the fact that the Israelis, they attack Lebanon, but they make sure to attack in an empty spot first to see what the reaction will be. I think they are, at the same time, they want to be hawkish, they want to be aggressive, but at the same time, they are scared, because I think deep down they know that if they wanted to take on Hezbollah one-on-one again, like they tried and failed in 2006, they should have done this like 10 years ago. They shouldn't have waited this long. And because what happened in the meantime, of course, Shahid Qasem Soleimani happened, the resistance in Syria happened, the massive Iranian support buildup for the resistance in Lebanon and in Syria itself happened all in the past couple of years, and has massively bolstered the resistance units in Lebanon itself and across the entire region. So the Israelis are really starting to come to terms, I think. The military strategists, they know deep down, of course they won't say it, but they know deep down that the prowess of on the military battlefield of Hezbollah is of such an extent nowadays that they can't expect to just go in there and fight them in the way that they were hoping to do back in the day, back in 2006. And that is why they are trying to find a new strategy. They are indeed, as has been said, they are trying to destabilize Hezbollah's power base by economically sabotaging Lebanon itself, by spreading misinformation through media and through their minions in Lebanon. But it is something that is, it's shaky at best. The way in which the Israelis are doing it now is at some points nearly amateuristic, because they are so uncertain on what they have to do and how they can take on Hezbollah on the battlefield.
Well, Jim, you talked about the destabilization, the attempt to destabilize Lebanon through economic means and social unrest. And, of course, the Secretary General of Hezbollah, Sayed Hassan Nasrallah, he addressed this and basically a message to the Israelis, don't try us, even though we have many, many problems, but the defense of Lebanon is the number one priority for the resistance. I want to talk about deterrence and the importance of that. If we see from 2006 until now that the Israelis hadn't attacked, do you think the tactics used by Hezbollah will continue to protect the country or not?
Well, I think that, you know, Hezbollah, as previous guests and I have said, you know, has built up its military capacity in such a way that it feels comfortable that it can reasonably protect the country and do damage, serious damage, and win perhaps and probably a military struggle against Israel. But these economic attacks are something else that are hard to counter in the way that, because the United States controls so much of the financial institutions of the world and the financial power of the world, that you can create a financial crisis, you can create an economic crisis, you know, you can make it difficult to buy things on the international market, you can create shortages of electricity and meat, et cetera. And this is the attempt that the United States makes throughout the world in regimes it wants to change to create suffering among the people that they can blame on the regime. Now, in this case, you have the United Americans and Israel trying to construct a narrative in which the problem is Hezbollah, okay? And, you know, that's going to resonate with some people in the sense that, you know, if there are people who don't care too much about the Palestinians in Lebanon, and there probably are some, you know, they're going to say, why should we be buffeted by this because the Hezbollah is there, you know, as a military threat to Israel. But I think that, as we've been saying, in general, in the last few years, the unity of Palestinian of the resistance on behalf of the Palestinians has strengthened. So I don't think it's going to work. I mean, we have to be humble and aware of the fact that this is a lot of economic power the United States has, and they're using it, and it can cause disruptions and disunity. That's what they want to do. They want to divide people, and they want them to blame Hezbollah for the problems they're having.
Well, Brett, I want to look at another angle of this, because this time around, there's growing solidarity among the resistance and its support for Hezbollah, from the Palestinian resistance movements to Iraq, Yemen, Syria, and Iran. They have all announced their solidarity and support of Hezbollah in fighting Israel. Your thoughts on this, the significance of this change this time around?
I think this is one of the most important developments that we have seen internationally speaking, and especially for West Asia in the past decade, basically, in the 21st century so far, is the development of a multipolar world order that has been spreading, has been developing all across the world, of course, with new superpowers and regional powers rising up and claiming their national sovereignty and their right to decide their own, to take their own matters into their own hands, away from the dictates of the United States and their allies. And this is, in the Islamic world in particular, this, of course, has been materializing in the Mukawama, in the Islamic resistance that has been spreading in across the Middle East, across Western Asia, and which often in the Western propaganda is called somewhat of a Shia crescent, even though it's in order to portray it as in a sectarian point, of course, in order, because that is as well, of course, is part of the propaganda mill in order to try to sow sectarian dissent and strife amongst the Muslim people. What we have seen in the past 20 years and what has scared the Western powers and the Zionists to such a massive degree is exactly that cooperation that we have seen between the Islamic Republic of Iran, the Syrian Arab Republic, the people of Lebanon, especially in Hezbollah. We have seen in Iraq, of course, ever since the conflict against Daesh, this has come to the forefront, the Hashd al-Sha'abi, the Popular Mobilization Forces, and other movements in Iraq who have been allying with this international movement of resistance against imperialism. And now, of course, in 2014, also the people of Yemen. This is something that has shown itself to be an extremely powerful strategy, and it shows the strength of solidarity across sectarian lines, across religious divides, across ethnic divides, against this war against Western Asia that has been going on for at least the past 100 years, ever since Sykes-Picot, the agreement between Sykes and Picot and the British and the French redistribution of Western Asian land between themselves, and of course since the Balfour Declaration, in which they agreed, the Western powers agreed to basically steal Palestinian land and give it to the Zionists. This is a constant war against the people of Western Asia and against the spirit of Islam itself that has been going on since the end of World War I at the very least. And this is something that has been, this conflict has been waged with the West gradually, like generally winning over and over again for the most part up until the last couple of decades, when now the West has been defeated bit by bit, and small battles at first, but bit by bit, gradually but steadily, they have been losing influence, and they have been losing to a variety of countries, a variety of political movements, a variety of religious groups, but who are all united together under the banner of anti-imperialism and the defense of the national sovereignty and of their national self-determination. And this is the most important thing that that is going on there right now, and that is exactly why Iran is one of the most important blame factors in Western propaganda, next to, of course, on a worldwide level, you have they blame things on Russia, they blame things on China, but everything related to the Middle East and to Western Asia in general, to the Arab world, will always be blamed on Iran. The war in Syria was blamed on Iran, the war in Yemen is being blamed on Iran, and the reason for that being that this Iran is seen, and rightfully so, I think, as some sort of a regional power and a regional hub of resistance. They have been uniting the powers of the forces of resistance, which we have seen beautifully during the inauguration of President Ibrahim Raisi, when people from all over the Islamic world came to Tehran in order to pay their respects and in order to basically congratulate the president on his election. This is a showcase of that global unity and that regional unity and collaboration, cooperation, and solidarity that has been growing in the area for the past 20 years.
And on that note, that brings us to the end of this spotlight. I appreciate both of you being with me. Author and journalist Jim Kavanaugh out of New York and historian and journalist Brett Yonkers out of Hasset. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Thanks so much for staying with us.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
The presence of different scholars.
And God said, let there be light, and there was light.
The Creator made Adam in his image, then placed the world in his care. May you walk alongside the Creator in righteousness.
God of Abraham, take my child into thy hands, that he may live to thy service.
God has spoken to us before, through Abraham, Noah, Moses, and through Jesus Christ. Why should we be so surprised that God speaks to us now through Muhammad?
Viewpoint, a critique of movies with religious themes on IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program Viewpoint, the movie critique program on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and my dear guest, Brother Hussein and Sayyid Abdullah. Assalamu alaikum, Sayyid Abdullah, and welcome to the program.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and thank you for having me.
My pleasure to have you back in the studio, as well as you, Brother Hussein.
Assalamu alaikum, I'm glad to be here.
Well, we were talking about the movie Gemini Man from the last episode on, based on the topic that we chose from fairly a long time ago. We were, in fact, shifting from one movie to another because we were talking about this topic, this very important topic of cloning. And there are some serious questions remaining about the morality of the issue under question, under investigation, I mean cloning. Let me start with you, Brother Hussein. What do you think of the morality of cloning? Is cloning, generally speaking, moral, ethical to develop and do it to human beings, not only to animals or plants, as we can see, like genetically modified food, for example, or products? So they have already done it to some vegetables or agricultural products, in addition to animals. But what about human beings?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. So cloning in Islam is a fairly new topic. I think, you know, it has a very wide range of, you know, points that we have to cover. So cloning itself, I feel like it's ethical only A, if the person consents, and B, if the subject doesn't get harmed, I guess, or isn't harmed. But that's pretty much it. Really, there is no. You can't just delete memories, for example, without. Without permission or modify things beyond benefit of the general public. Like, for example, in the movie Replicas, they were making clones so that they can use them for the purpose of war, or they can use them as weapons,
mm-hmm.
as the boss admits,
yes.
to the doctor. So, of course, that would be wrong, but if you're using them for the good, if you're using them to make, like, doctors, engineers, people who are actually going to impact the world positively, then I guess there is a way that you can make it work.
Mm-hmm, I see. Sayyid Abdullah, what do you think of morality, or whether cloning, generally speaking, being immortal, do you think that there are certain criteria that we can put in there and say that, for example, as Brother Hussein was referring to, like if it puts the person or other people in a harm way, if it provides the benefits for the others, then it makes it moral or immoral?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
There are two things here, right? Two issues here. There is the jurisprudential aspect, whether it's halal or haram, mm-hmm. allowed or forbidden.
Yes.
And there's the moral aspect of it. If you want my personal opinion is one thing, if you want Islam opinion is another thing as well.
I see.
As far as my opinion is concerned, when it comes to cloning, it's always a question of why. Like, it's not a moral issue. It's more of why would you want to have a clone? Why would you want to have a replica of yourself, someone that looks like you? Obviously, we expressed the point enough that you cannot have a person that is exactly you in and out, because mm-hmm. you would have to have a copy of your soul too, which said that's impossible.
Yes.
So you can have someone identical to you in terms of biology, right? So why would you want to have someone that looks like you? In terms, for example, if in Japan and other countries, they were able to, like you said, copy vegetables, or they copy rats and copy other creatures, and it succeeded. It's
yes.
successful. They can reproduce different form of life forms that are identical in
mm-hmm.
looks.
Yes.
They can do that. So if I want to have a child that looks like me, it's a question of why, not whether it's moral or not moral. You know what I mean?
Yes.
So this is the thing. So if you ask me, is it moral to me? Well, I say it depends on the person.
Yes.
Like, why would you want to have a clone? If it makes sense to you, if this is what you like, then by all means. It's not a
yes.
matter of a moral value. But if you look at it from an Islamic perspective, obviously the answer will change and would differ.
Mm-hmm. I would ask you some more questions regarding that, but
sure.
in the second part of our episode. Let's take a break.
Don't you think your country deserves a perfect version of you? There is no perfect version of me. Or him, or anybody.
No.
He was on his way to Yemen. Now, thanks to you, his place is going to be taken by someone with parents. Someone who feels pain. Fear, which we had edited out of him. Someone with just as many weaknesses as the terrorists that we're trying to kill. And you're going to tell me that's better.
So why not make a whole army of them?
Yeah, why not? Think how many American families we could spare. Nobody's son or daughter would ever have to die. No vet comes home with PTSD and kills himself. We can keep the whole world safe without any actual grief. So who would I be hurting?
Back to the program Viewpoint on IRIB English Radio. We were talking about Gemini Man. Sayyid Abdullah, you raised very serious issues. Like you said that when I asked you the question of morality, whether it is ethical to have a copy of you or something like that, you said it's a question of why, not first like religion or jurisprudence or something like that, or even morality. Well, how do you defer these things? And also, you also deferred it and distinguished it from the question of Islam.
Mm-hmm.
I know that morality or the realm of ethics is quite different from jurisprudence.
Mm.
All right, and these could go different ways, or they could overlap. By the way, in some, for example, some areas. Cases. Yeah. Mm. All right. So, how do you define these differences? Would you give us more examples? You also said it's a question of why.
Mm.
All right, and if we pass that question, all right, like for example, we wanted to, let's say, have a copy of Albert Einstein, a scientist, or Ibn Sina, or these.
But only his looks, though. You can only gonna ha- you, can, you only.
But what about their
have.
Their brain? What you about
can't.
Their smartness?
You can't.
Intelligence.
The intelligence is not in the brain, not in the actual organ. So you're not gonna have a copy of Einstein with his knowledge. You're gonna have a copy of the body of Einstein. So you're gonna have a twin, basically. So when you have two twins, identical twins, they look identical, but the inside is completely different. The way they think is completely different. Their intellect is completely different. Their IQ is completely different.
But you're comparing some natural identical twins, with something which is unnatural, something which is being manipulated by man, something manipulated in the way that they can make it better, stronger, like Gemini Man.
Yeah, so like I said, sometimes we're talking hypothetical, science fiction, that's one thing. Sometimes we're talking about real life, that's another thing. Because you have to understand that any matter that comes to Islam, right, Islam has to look at it from the perspective of its reality, it's being done or it could be done, or can I do it? Islam will only look at it if it can take place on the outside. If it's just a hypothetical science fiction, Islam would not touch it, would not even come to it. You know what I mean?
Yes.
So unless it's can be applied. So for example, you said, okay, we take Einstein's DNA, we go to his grave, we dig his grave, we take a hair, we take his DNA, and we can reproduce through the normal process another human, right?
Mm-hmm.
That he will look like Einstein. But would it be Einstein himself? No, it won't. Would he carry some of Einstein's smartness or geniuses, there's a possibility,
and that's the purpose of the whole thing.
there's a possibility, but would it give you this? Because you have to understand that the brain, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala gave it to you as a vegetable, just nothing in it, just plain, like in replicas where he said the brain was empty, and if you leave it, it will grow in 20 days. He said the body would grow, it will age dramatically, so therefore he needed to sedate the body so the brain stops functioning, right? So you have that fresh brain, Allah gives it to you, and then Allah puts the soul, and the soul uses the brain to produce information. So my brain, your brain, and brother Hussein's brain, all the same brain. The only difference between our brain is the machine that operates, which is the soul. So if Einstein's soul is not there, whatever rider that will take that body, he will not use it in the same way Einstein did. Does that make sense?
Yes.
So even if we give him the strengths, even if we give him, we manipulate the DNA to be the best, that person, the soul that will take, inhabit that body, maybe he will say, you know what, stop this. I don't want to be a scientist. I want to, just play games and have fun.
Or gangster.
Or gangster.
So that would be a dangerous gangster.
Yeah, so
Albert Einstein was
going to be a smart gangster.
This is
the thing. This is the dilemma we're working here with.
Thank you very much. Let's take another break and we'll be back.
The Gemini lab's been dismantled. Cloning program is history.
And Junior?
He's untouchable. No one will bother him. Ever. And we checked. There are no more clones.
What about you?
IG called. I'm looking at charges, but if I marry Janet, I can make a deal.
Back to the program. Viewpoint, the movie critique program on IRIB English Radio, with me, Mohammad Javad, hosting this program, and my dear guests, as always, are still Sayyid Abdullah and Brother Hussein. Brother Hussein, do you agree with what Sayyid Abdullah was saying in the earlier part of our program?
Yes.
I asked him the question that you asked, the question of why, and then I said, well, you can have like Albert Einstein or somebody else like Isaac Newton or some of these scientists like Ibn Sina copied, yeah. and continue with them, and the whole the whole world would change with these scientists and science developing, you know.
Yeah. So in terms of physical attributes, we've already agreed that we can, you know, in this current world, we can clone people to look like others, right? Like we can take the strongest man on Earth,
mm-hmm.
we can clone him, and he'll turn out the exact same.
Yes.
Well, you know, not the exact same. Well, actually, yeah, maybe. You know, he'd have to go through the same mental, I guess, processes, and he'd have to learn exactly, like, how to keep his body healthy, how to, you know, exercise every day. But, yes, other than that, if you're trying to clone a person like Einstein, we've already agreed that we can't clone the soul. So if we can copy his mind, which we probably can't, but if we can, then yes, I guess it would be a successful experiment. But
what was Sayyid Abdullah talking about was that, you know, we cannot create the soul. And what's the driving force behind everybody, even the brain of Albert Einstein, even if you copy another person, yeah. another individual, that would not be exactly the same Albert Einstein you expect it to be.
Yeah.
So because you cannot create the soul, you cannot put the soil there, or
but if you could
clone the soul,
if you could create the soul,
that would be another story then. That's what Sayyid Abdullah was saying, that it's a possibility. Maybe in very distant future, or maybe in near future. Yes.
Well, no, if the soul's you look not at a possibility. You cannot copy the soul.
Yes.
Yeah, but according to the question, if you look at it from a scientific perspective, like, or an atheist perspective, you think, okay, well, we have the mind and we have the body, okay? If we are, like in that movie, replicas, if we can clone both, then yeah, still there will be differences. For example, this Albert Einstein would be interested in mathematics, physics, science, whatever. But the other one might not be interested in the same thing because, you know, it really depends on his personality, which is something that you can't clone. You know, you can't clone what the mind is, what you know, how he thinks or what he thinks about. Those are things that are very random, I guess.
Mm-hmm. I see. Okay, thank you very much.
Yeah.
Thank you, Brother Hussein, and thank you, Sayyid Abdullah, for your contribution to the program, Viewpoint on IRIB English Radio. We were talking about the movie Gemini Man and some related issues such as cloning. Thank you very much for listening to this program. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Join us in this journey, IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Thank you.
reporters. Meet Nura, an Iranian-made COVID vaccine, which is now making a name for itself. Developed by Iran's Baghiyatullah University, affiliated to the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, the vaccine wrapped up the first human trial stage and now kick-started the second phase.
The first trial phase involved giving jabs to 70 people. The vaccine has not created any serious side effects in the volunteers, so we can now conclude that the vaccine is safe. The second phase will cover up to 500 volunteers, and the third and final stage will inject Nura to at least 20,000 people. It's only then we can decide on the efficiency of the vaccine.
Nura is a recombinant vaccine, which experts say provides stronger immune response to the virus compared to jabs that work based on other methods, such as mRNA and inactivated virus. Nura is administered in three stages. The first and second doses are injected 21 days apart, and the third one is administered 2 weeks after the second shot.
Well, Nura jumped a bit late on the bandwagon to fight the coronavirus. It stands out as the only Iranian vaccine that can be administered to children and teens. Experts hope that this would make it safe to reopen schools.
With less than 1 month and a half left to the upcoming school season, authorities in Iran are still debating whether or not to resume in-person classes, which have in the past year given way to online learning. Nura developers say they're trying their best to get their jabs to the market, as they're certain that their vaccine will protect children between 12 and 18 against the coronavirus.
Based on our studies, our vaccine is both safe and effective to be used for people between 12 and 18 years old. Simultaneously with the second trial phase, we'll also kickstart the first stage of the trials on volunteers from this age group.
Developers say if all goes as planned, Nura will hit the market in 3 months. This as Iran has already rolled out its first local vaccine, dubbed Coviran, with a monthly output of up to 15 million doses per month. The country also plans to release Covpars, among other jabs, within the next 2 months. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader Kim Jong-un, has blasted the decision to hold joint U.S.-South Korea military exercises in South Korea this month. Her statement, read on official media, also called for the removal of U.S. troops and weapons from the Korean Peninsula.
The U.S. is determinedly pushing forward with these aggressive war drills when international attention is focused on the development of the situation on the Korean Peninsula. It is indeed the chief architect destroying peace and stability in the region. And this also proves that diplomatic engagement and dialogue with no strings attached touted by the present U.S. administration is hypocrisy to cover up its aggressive nature.
The U.S. administration of President Joe Biden has reached out for, quote, unconditional talks with Pyongyang. Although U.S.-led United Nations Security Council sanctions over North Korea's nuclear weapons program remain in place, experts consider North Korea's perspective.
The most important thing is the content of the joint exercises. Officially, they're described as defensive in nature, but if you look closely, they employ very offensive strategies, preemptively striking North Korea, removing state leadership, and capturing North Korean territory. It's threatening from the North Korean standpoint.
South Korean President Moon Jae-in had been trying to generate peace with North Korea, but Seoul's close alliance with Washington and purchase of major U.S. weapons has hindered his efforts toward Pyongyang.
The decision to go ahead with the joint U.S.-South Korea military exercises has already impacted inter-Korean relations. In late July, hotline communications between the two Koreas were restored after being severed for more than a year. However, since the announcement of the drills, North Korea is no longer answering South Korea's calls. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Of
After 5 years of the closure imposed on Sana'a International Airport by Saudi Arabia, Yemen has held a protest inside the airport to renew their demands and call for its reopening. Protesters chanted slogans urging the international community to push Riyadh to remove its merciless blockade on Yemen.
The closure of Sana'a International Airport has caused a major humanitarian crisis and it is a war crime. Yemenis are not trapped and considered hostages. The Ministry of Health statistics confirmed that more than 95,000 patients have died because they were unable to travel for treatment, and 480,000 patients urgently need to travel and their fate is unknown amid the continued closure of Sana'a Airport. There are also 4 million expatriates who want to return, but the airport closure prevented them.
The repercussions of the Saudi violation of international covenant on civil and political rights and closing Sana'a International Airport are getting worse, especially to those with chronic diseases such as cancer, kidney failure, and liver, who hope to travel abroad for proper medical treatment, but unfortunately it seems impossible, at least for a while.
5 years since the closure of Sana'a Airport, which is not a short period, it has caused an exacerbation of human suffering because the airport is the only outlet for millions of Yemenis. Before the war, 6,000 passengers, including 100 patients, used to leave every day from Sana'a Airport. More than 30 patients die every day due to the restrictions on the airport. There are more than 70,000 cancer patients and 20,000 kidney failure patients who need to travel for treatment amid the collapse of the healthcare system due to the fuel crisis caused by the Saudi detention of Yemeni oil ships.
At the beginning of 2015, Saudi Arabia imposed an all-out blockade on Yemen besides its rule, resulting in the closure of Sana'a International Airport to all flights and trapping millions of Yemenis, including patients, in a war zone. However, Sana'a Airport still receives the United Nations flights alone on a daily basis.
Thousands of Yemeni patients, including children, have died while waiting for a chance to travel through this airport. People here say the Saudi blockade goes against international law and its requirement that everyone should be free to leave any country, including their own. Abdul Latif Al Washali, Sana'a.
The continuing fallout over Britain's Prince Andrew's friendship with the deceased sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. A lawsuit brought against the Duke by mother of three, Virginia Giuffre, who alleges she was trafficked to the Prince by Epstein and his co-conspirator, Ghislaine Maxwell, when she was 17 and forced to sleep with him on three occasions. In a statement later, Giuffre said the powerful and rich are not exempt from being held responsible for their actions. I hope that other victims will see that it is possible not to live in silence and fear, but to reclaim one's life by speaking out and demanding justice. But the Queen's son denies any wrongdoing.
Things only started snowballing after that infamous interview. The humiliated royal was evicted from his private office in the building behind me at his mother's orders. Add to that the slew of companies and institutions that severed all ties with him.
66-year-old Epstein is said to have committed suicide in a U.S. jail in 2019, a month after he was arrested over sex trafficking charges. His partner in crime, Ghislaine Maxwell, has pleaded not guilty to those charges and is awaiting trial in November. It is yet to be seen how the Duke or the beleaguered British royal family will emerge from this new looming storm. Saeed Purizza, London.
Saudi Arabia issued sentences against 69 Palestinians and Jordanians residing in the kingdom, with some handed jail terms up to 22 years, while acquitting a number of detainees. Among the detainees is Hamas senior member Mohammed al-Khudri, who was sentenced to 15 years. His son was also given a 3-year jail term. Palestinians have slammed the court ruling, saying it follows the Israeli goal of defeating the Palestinian resistance.
This was shocking news for us, as we never expected things would reach this level. They sentenced the national man who is representing his country and works within the law of Saudi Arabia. Mohammed didn't pass the limits and he was guided and directed by Saudi authorities. It is really sad for us as they don't have any right to sentence him to this term. This verdict is unjustified.
In February, Al-Khudri had a surgery. He was being treated for cancer when Saudi authorities arrested him. Al-Khudri, who has been in charge of working on ties with Saudi Arabia for 2 decades, is now on a wheelchair inside the Saudi jail.
I hope things will be better and we will get our brother and his son released, as he is an old man while his health is deteriorating. He has recently done a surgery for his cancer and he is on wheelchair. I hope Saudi authorities reconsider this ruling and stand by the Palestinians.
Hamas and the Palestinian factions have condemned the sentences, calling them unjust, saying those sentenced had done nothing to harm Saudi Arabia. Hamas also welcomed the acquittal of some of the detainees and called on Saudi authorities to quickly release them.
We totally condemn this decision and reject the ruling against our sons in Saudi Arabia, and we consider them political prosecutions. Saudi Arabia doesn't have the right to sentence those people who didn't commit any offense against the kingdom and its people. This is an unjust decision, as Saudi Arabia has always supported Palestinians, but now it is trying to satisfy the U.S. and Israel. We call on Saudi authorities to release those detainees.
Palestinians here say the Israeli move further sours relations between the Palestinian nation and Saudi Arabia, calling on Riyadh to release those detainees as they have caused no harm and not committed any offense. Ruba Shavit, Gaza.
Black flag was waved high on Tehran's sky in honor of a man who has inspired Muslims for more than 13 centuries, Imam Hussein. This symbolic ceremony marked the beginning of an annual tradition that commemorates the third Imam of Shia Muslims and mourns his tragic martyrdom at the hands of the cruel ruler of the time.
This is the fourth consecutive year that we at the Abbasabad Hills Complex raised the symbolic flag of Imam Hussein over the city of Tehran to ring in the 10-day Muharram ceremonies. This is the tallest flagpole in the Middle East, measuring 150 meters in height, so it can be seen from many neighborhoods in Tehran.
Every year on Imam Hussein's martyrdom anniversary, Shia Muslims in Iran and across the world take part in mass mourning processions for 10 days, starting on the first day of the lunar month of Muharram. For the second year now, the ceremonies have been largely limited because of the coronavirus pandemic. Tehran City Council says it has restricted this year's ceremonies to open-air venues with smaller numbers of people.
We plan to hold a safe Muharram this year. Mourners are obliged to observe health protocols. Imam Hussein commemoration is a tradition that has been around for centuries, but what's important is the ideology of Imam Hussein that should be preserved, and our people need to be cautious and not hold the processions in large numbers.
Imam Hussein and 72 of his companions were killed in Karbala in 680 AD after they refused to pay allegiance to then Umayyad ruler Yazid ibn Muawiyah. Islamic references have it that Yazid diverted Islam from the true version that was introduced by Prophet Muhammad. Being the Prophet's grandson, Imam Hussein tried to revive the true Islam by resisting against Yazid. For centuries, Imam Hussein has taught lessons of freedom to millions of people across generations through the annual commemoration ceremonies. This is the second year that mourning processions have been curtailed amid the coronavirus pandemic. But Muslims say his legacy is here to stay. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Iran has condemned the remarks by European Union officials on the recent attack against an Israeli-owned tanker as irresponsible. Speaking at his online weekly press conference, Iran's foreign ministry spokesman Saeed Khatibzadeh rejected the accusations as baseless, saying blaming Iran is a scenario planned by the Israeli regime and that the comments by EU officials do not contribute to the peace and stability of the region.
Such remarks by EU officials do not contribute to the peace and stability of the region. Tehran has summoned the British and Romanian envoys in Tehran to register protest against the baseless allegations. The fact that Britain has sided with the rebellious and notorious Zionist regime shows the position of this country.
In reaction to a statement released by the G7 against Tehran, the officials said the country will not remain silent in the face of the security of its commercial vessels. He further noted that the security of the Persian Gulf is Iran's red line, and that the country has always tried to keep this waterway safe from insecurities created by such countries as UK.
Iran is concerned about the obvious violation that the UK did against an Iranian oil tanker in international waters in July 2019. But the security of the Persian Gulf is the red line for Iran. Tehran has done its best to protect the waterway from insecurities orchestrated by countries like the UK. We advise the British government to pay attention to its own responsibilities and duties.
Tension has been escalating in the region in recent weeks against the backdrop of a suspected drone attack last week that targeted an Israeli-managed tanker, Mercer Street, off the Omani coast. The regime in Tel Aviv and its Western allies, the UK and the US, accuse Iran of orchestrating the attack. Iran has vehemently rejected the charges as baseless and childish. Moreover, Tel Aviv said it is ready to strike Iran in retaliation for the attack. But Iran has already warned of a crushing response to any such move. Iran describes as suspicious a number of reported security incidents in the Persian Gulf region and has warned against any effort to create a vicious atmosphere to pursue certain political goals. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
Starting almost a year ago as the first viable Iranian vaccine candidate, Coviran is now a household name in Iran. After passing all the clinical trials, Coviran launched its first production line 3 months ago and now has inaugurated the second line, which will more than quadruple the output capacity to roughly 15 million doses per month.
The second facility is larger than the first production line. It went operational today and will add some 8 million doses to the current capacity, getting the overall output to between 12 and 1 million doses a month. This will cover much of our domestic demand for vaccines.
With U.S. sanctions casting their shadow on the import of vaccines into Iran, the inoculation program has been slow in the country. The Delta variant has now swept across Iran, killing at least 400 people every day. Coviran says it is speeding up its efforts to produce as many jabs as possible to stem the tide of Delta, as they claim their vaccine can terminate the new variant.
There is a test called virus neutralization test, or VNT, which studies how much a vaccine can protect the body against a virus. The Delta variant has not yet proven to be vaccine evading, but based on VNT experiments conducted on Coviran, it can neutralize the Delta variant as well.
So far, Coviran has produced and administered 7 million doses. The biotech firm says it will launch a third production facility, which will add 10 million more doses each month, boosting the overall output to 25 million. Given a monthly domestic demand of less than 15 million, Coviran says the extra doses will be exported to other countries.
Coviran developers say their vaccine has so far covered 35% of the entire vaccination program in the country. They hope with the launching of the second production line here, the government will no longer need to rely on foreign jabs to inoculate its citizens. Yusuf Jalali from Coviran production facility in Alborz province.
Another episode in the British government's harsh immigration policy. A deportation flight planned for August 11th. On board, 19 people of Jamaican origins in this country for up to 30 years now.
The UK Home Office, responsible for immigration, has called those deportees foreign offenders, people who have come here and committed crimes and should expect to be removed.
But immigrant rights groups such as the Movement for Justice say the move is a reversal of an earlier agreement between the UK and Jamaican governments not to deport people who arrived in the UK as minors.
These are not people who should be deported. I deal very often with people who have lived in the country as children, or who have lived here for a very, very long time, or have been convicted of offences that aren't at the most serious end of the offences. So I have seen people for low-level drug dealing, not necessarily condoning it, but it is low-level drug dealing. There's all sorts